Good afternoon, and welcome back to Next Evolution of Health. We had some fantastic sessions this morning. We'll make those recordings available to you as soon as possible. Jeffrey's processing them as we speak. And now I have the distinct honor and pleasure to introduce Dr. Marilyn Schlitz, who's the president and CEO. She's going to be hosting this next dialogue that we're going to focus on consciousness and healing and really turn the focus more to the practical applications of these new paradigms of medicine and health and healing and research and how that applies in our own lives. So first, a few words about Marilyn. First, we used to work together, and she's a truly delightful woman who's both brilliant intellectually but also a woman of great heart. And she's spent the last 15 years at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, where she's bridging work in psychophysiology, cross-cultural healing, and consciousness studies. She's done training background in psychology, behavioral and social science, and philosophy, and even anthropology. So she's a real integrator of a lot of different perspectives, which has allowed her to help to bring together and advance this whole field of integral medicine and applying the new consciousness research to how we shift our view of healing. So Marilyn, thank you so much for being part of this weekend and leading this panel, and I'll let you introduce Elliot and Janet.
Great, Stephen, thank you, and thank you for putting together this day. What an extraordinary opportunity for people to get such a wealth of insight and information. And I want to really thank Elliot Dasher and Janet Quinn for joining me. Elliot is an MD who worked with the Institute of Noetic Sciences at various times and developing our integral health program and working in the area of consciousness and healing. He is now teaching at a local hospital in Martha's Vineyards, creating programs on consciousness and health, and has a new book coming out called Precious Lives. He's also written a number of other books, including one on integral health that is very relevant to our topic today. And then Janet Quinn, who also has been part of the Institute of Noetic Sciences work since, well, a long time. We won't go into how long because it's just been so rich and dynamic. And she is somebody who is a PhD nurse and an educator. She's been really pioneering in the area of interspiritual guidance. She's a consultant for various healthcare organizations around this concept that she's developed on habitats for health. And it's a beautiful thing. She also has a book, I Am a Woman, Finding My Voice, which is meditations and affirmations for women who are attempting to live a healthful life. So thank you guys for being here. And I think the way to start would be to invite each of you to tell me a little bit about your work today and what is really giving you passion as it relates to this move toward consciousness and healing. So, Elliot, you want to start us off?
Sure. Well, just to begin with my background, because I think it's relevant to where I am right now, I practice internal medicine full-time for 21 years. At the end of that period of time, I really decided I needed to get a more depth education, actually a second medical education, to really deepen my work, both in my own life and with clients. And so for the next 12 years, which brings me almost up to date, I went back and forth to Asia probably about a total of 2 to 2.5 years studying meditative practices and Eastern philosophy to see how they would apply to the world that I live in back here. And I consider that my second medical education. And at the conclusion of that, of course, it's still ongoing, but of the most intense phase, I wrote Integral Health to try to create a model based upon these four quadrants of health, these four aspects of health, the psycho-spiritual, biological, interpersonal, and our relationship to culture, as a way of integrating East and West. After I worked with that for a while, after it was published, it became quite clear to me the driving force behind integral health really at this time and this, in our culture and in our medicine is really the development of consciousness or the psycho-spiritual quadrant, because that is the place that's been most denied and most undervalued in our culture. And in addition to that, it's what drives and underlies all the other aspects of integral health. In other words, one has to expand consciousness to have richer interpersonal relationships, to be able to move from having the world serve me to how I serve the world, requires an increase in consciousness, and even in terms of working with our biology to get to the more subtle aspects of mind-body healing and mind-body strategies, we have to get to the more subtle aspects of consciousness first, or develop those capacities. And so my focus went on, became how to help people grow their consciousness. And so I began to develop about 3 years ago a program that's been done about 14 times at the local hospital with about 300 people. I started there because I wanted to have just people who had never meditated before or had never studied this stuff before, who hadn't been at spiritual centers, but just had the kinds of problems that they wanted to deal with, an overactive mind, stress, distress. And we developed a 10-week program to teach in a very personalized way practices, both as formal sitting practices and as daily practices, listening, loving kindness, etc. And I've done that about 14 times. And it's been an amazing experience to see how it is that people can come to develop a stable practice when it's appropriate, approached appropriately, and the kind of results that can be found to occur in life very, very early on, from diminishment of reactivity to improved relationships and from there. So my work now is currently continuing this process of working with people and refining how, with people who have not been in the consciousness movement, we can actually establish the kinds of practices and life foundation which will allow them to really integrally change their life by changing their consciousness. So that's where I am now.
That's beautiful. So really trying to integrate these principles of spirituality and psychology into people's everyday practice so that they can, I assume from what you're talking about, really stay healthy and prevent illness. Is that correct?
Yes, and undergo, you know, a self-transformation. The moment you begin to really explore this black box of the mind and begin to understand you can make changes and that you can understand how thoughts, feelings, and images work, why the mind is overactive, what causes emotional afflictions, what causes stress and distress. That, in fact, as the traditional teachings have told us in every tradition, that distress, stress, and suffering can be brought to a permanent end progressively because it's not an innate part of our being, and that the qualities of human flourishing, a self-generated, enduring inner happiness, sustained peace, a sense of optimal well-being, is there for every person to achieve. So those are the two goals, bringing the stress and suffering to an end and to develop an optimal well-being of body, mind, and spirit. And it's sure possible. That's what they've all told us over the years and generations. And that's what we start with, and that's what we aim for, and that's what this title of Precious Life is about.
Well, let's come back to some of the specifics of that, but let's hear from Janet first. And just to say that nurses really are one of those great resources for our culture that have always been in tune with the healing potentials and the role as healers. And so, Janet, tell us now, as a nurse and as a healer and as a spokesperson for a new paradigm of healthcare, what gives you passion today?
Well, first I have to respond to Elliot with just a deep sigh and let you know, Elliot, once again how touched I am by you and your work and also by the parallels in our work. And so I'll say more about that. And I want to say hello to everybody that's out there that's listening and really acknowledge that as we sit together, none of us is sitting alone. When Elliot and I just first greeted each other in the green room behind the curtain before we talked to you, our hearts opened. We were happy to meet each other. And I said, of course, there's no distance. And so I would say to all of you that are listening, no distance. We sit together now. And if you even take a moment, you can check in with us. Check it out as your own reality. Don't take my word for it. But simply turn your awareness to your own being and see if you can't begin to feel a sense of the connection to, we're told hundreds of people on this call, and so we can imagine that these are hearts that are hearts and minds, souls, beings in many different locations physically, but we can simply just by choice, just by shifting awareness, just start to feel ever so gently the connection of these hearts and souls and minds, and imagine that we sit in this one beautiful circle surrounding this planet with, now just for a moment, a deep intention for healing for the whole planet, a deep sense of loving kindness that we hold for ourselves, that we connect to each other on the call, and then we allow it to simply spread and encompass this entire planet and all sentient beings, with the deep wish that we hold in our hearts that all beings may be well and all beings may be free from suffering and all beings be at peace. And so just to take a breath and breathe that wish, we come into experience of the precise thing that we're here to talk about, which is consciousness and healing, at the heart of which is that there is no separation. The heart of the message of consciousness and healing is that separate body, a body separate from mind and spirit, is an illusion, and an individual human being separate from every other creature is an illusion. So this is the fundamental knowing of consciousness and healing. And of course, there's all the pathways to that knowing. We can learn about it at the material level, which is our research and our science. We can learn about it through the science of the heart and the soul, which is what Elliot was talking about, his second medical education. And to come back to my own work, I would say that also is my second education, a deep, deep engagement with the perennial wisdom, with this immense inheritance that we have as human beings of the spiritual knowing and experience of all of our ancestors through thousands and thousands of years. This is collectively the perennial wisdom or the perennial philosophy, and just now really emerging as a new language called interspirituality, the capacity of us to share experiences across these traditions. So that's just by way of, I felt just an impulse to do that.
Thank you. It was beautiful. I thought it was a beautiful way to begin. So thank you for that.
So I could say a little bit more just about my work, because it is this work. It's at this stage in my life, Elliot and I both have, and Marilyn, I mean, all the three of us really have known each other for like decades and have been walking this path together for decades. And so for me, I'm at a certain point in my life, and the question that Mary Oliver asks at the end of one of her poems, she's one of my favorite poets, is, tell me, what is it you intend to do with your one wild and precious life? I ask that to all our listeners. What is it you intend to do with your one wild and precious life? And so at this stage, it takes on new poignancy. It's kind of like, what is it you intend to do with what's left of your one wild and precious life, you know? So for me, it's really, what's the work of my heart and the work of my soul? And that's what I'm engaged in. And so the work of my heart and soul at one level is a private practice that I do with people in person and by phone in spiritual guidance, using the perennial wisdom, this interspiritual framework, so that I can really walk with people from any tradition or none as they seek to deepen their connection to their own spiritual truth, their own connection to what's true and good and beautiful, and then live out of that place. That's one place that I'm very passionate. And then my other work is, as you said, with organizations around creating habitats for healing, which I see as environments in which the staff in them are vital and are healing, and at the same time the best quality of care is being delivered. And this comes out of my deep love of nursing over many years and my very deep concern, not just for nurses, but for all healthcare providers in this system, for what I call healthcare professional sustainability, and the recognition that we've got to have a different model for our healthcare delivery if we're going to, in fact, have a sustained working force, because we're losing them. They can't be sustained in these situations. So that's another element. And then finally, my work with creating programs for the way of the healer, and then touching body and tending soul. So I feel like I've said enough. I don't want to take up too much space, but those are a few of the things that I'm passionate about at the moment. And I apologize for the croaky voice. I've got a cold. So there you have it.
Part of our integral life is the embodiment of these I the collective aspects of how we share germs is part of our community, the community of an ecosystem. So let me turn back to Elia and ask if, in some practical ways, you could help us to understand what kinds of things are you teaching people as they come into this program, and what are some of those insights that can help each of us to be more fully whole and healthy?
Well, at the beginning, the piece that Janet just quoted from Mary Oliver, which really goes with the whole Buddhist teaching, the first teaching about the preciousness of human life. We spend time in the beginning simply recognizing this extraordinary possibility of being human, the consciousness we have. There are no other beings that we know of, animals in the animal kingdom, that can consciously choose to alleviate emotional distress and suffering, that can consciously choose and set up the causes for happiness. And we're alone have that possibility, and yet we're asleep from that most of our lives, and we don't really often activate it. So there is the motivation of trying to bring to awareness for all of us in the room, or when I do this individually, how much of an opportunity we have. And it's really important to get across to people that, and for them to feel that sense of this preciousness that's there in their life, that it's not that there is a seed. Like butter and milk, you have to churn the milk to get butter. You have to do the work to take the seed of possibility. So the early work is really around that, that motivation. And then we begin to work with two sets of practices. One, the formal sitting practice, which is designed basically to tame the mind, because until the mind is quiet, the overactive mind quiets, one can't really begin to experience the deeper aspects of mind and the insights and the capacities that are there. So we begin that, and we spend time throughout the 10 weeks stabilizing that practice. And what I've learned is it really needs to be, it's not a relaxation technique. This is a practice of taming the mind, sitting in an undistracted mind, and ultimately moving into a place of settled awareness. So it's a progressive process, and it's really important for people to learn that in a very individually tailored way, because each person has different capacities and so on. So we do spend a lot of time practicing and going over people's practices, their problems, the obstacles, so that I know at the end of 10 weeks they can be stabilized in that. But the other really important thing is working on using all of life as a practice, because we don't have enough time to simply we go to a monastery or a seminary and really commit long periods of time. And yet every relationship, every interaction, work itself, every piece of time that we touch adversity, every challenge we face, and the negativity or afflictions in another person or ourselves, each one of those is an opportunity for practice. So we learn how to listen, how to use listening as a meditative skill to hear another person, enhance relationships. We learn how to decide what we need to cultivate and abandon in our life in order to have the kind of life we want, how to deal with afflictive emotions, both didactically and as I said, there's a manual that's fairly substantial. How to work with work so we can slowly and progressively find ways in which we serve rather than see it as a place of only meeting our material needs, relationships, etc. So by we weave this tapestry of practices in life, daily life, the formal practice, and by weaving that tapestry both by intellectually, by understanding where we're going, and by through practice, by learning experientially, by opening heart and mind, we end up with a process by which people's lives transform themselves from simple things like less reactivity, seeing other people's afflictions from a place of compassion rather than resentfulness or anger, and so on. So it's this wonderful tapestry. And at the end of that 10 weeks, for most people, there's a commitment to practice, which is a wonderful beginning, changes they can already see, so they're no longer pushed by suffering, or pushed by distress, or pushed by an intolerable, overactive mind, but they're pulled by what they see as positivity emerging in their life. And for the first time, they have an exit strategy for stress, distress, emotional disorders. They have a way out rather than helplessness or just treatments that buy time. And that opening to really see that inside each of us, there is this place of stillness. There is this place of well-being. there is this place of a delight and happiness, to touch that even for a moment is to be opened into the possibility of stabilizing that over time. So this is what I try to do through a lot of intellectual content, very heavy practice content, very well individually tailored, very well integrated into life as well as into formal practice. I really try to get them on a path which becomes a one-way street and is irreversible. And our experience has been fantastic. We've had doctors, kitchen workers, firemen, teachers, people taking it out to others. And the results are, you know, I hate to say the results have been, everybody's always speaking like that, but I must say every time I sit in these classes, I become extremely humble and extremely astonished at what's possible, and feel so deeply in me the tragedy that people live asleep for so many years and live with such sadness and struggle when it's totally unnecessary. So that's the kind of development we do in that program. Mm,
that's beautiful.
In my own life first, Marilyn, I think this is the major problem with healers in general, that one has to take the time to do one's own work and continuously in order to be able to be authentic and have an inner understanding of what one is trying to do, so that one's life gets transformed into an instrument for service, which is what I bring to all of them. That, you know, when they say thank you at the end of the course, I say thank you with my practice, with your practice. That's the thanks I need, and pass it on to help other people. So that's the work we've been doing, and I think for the first time, 300 people now later, many of them been with them in and out for 3 years. Many of them retake the course. I have really found the process by which change can actually be accomplished in people, and it's just an incredibly remarkable experience and feeling.
Listening to you talk reminds me, you know, we did this book, Living Deeply, and it was based in interviews with 60 masters from different traditions, and interviews and survey data we did with thousands of people, really looking at how it is that we can effectively transform our consciousness in ways that invite this kind of healing and peace and serenity that you're describing. And one of the things, you know, we created a change model out of the research that looked at these kind of noetic experiences, these direct personal experiences that can really catalyze us in this directional move, and I guess in our work we saw that it's continually refining, so that it's not really linear but constantly iterative as people are attempting to explore their own consciousness and understand the nature of transformation. But what really reminded me as I was listening to you talk is, as we put this change model together, you know, first of all, the impetus to change and some kind of direct personal experience that speaks to something else, maybe something bigger or more resilient in our lives. And it often comes from suffering, some kind of pain or adversity that triggers us to seek a new path forward. And then looking at all the pitfalls of that, you know, we can get either into a state of denial where we just simply don't want to change and so we maintain that steady state, or we can begin to move forward and explore what is possible, what are the inklings of new insights that come to us as we've had these kinds of experiences. And you know, the pitfall there is that people can be in endless seeking without really recognizing that, you know, they're living it and it is, you know, part of the manifesting of everyday life. And then we saw that all of the teachers that we interviewed talked about the importance of practice, you know, with one exception, and even her view was that there's still practice, but you don't want to call it practice because people get caught up in the practice and not the living of it. But finally, this change model really leads us into the idea that, and many of the teachers we interviewed talked about how important it is, you know, to get off the pillow or the pew, out of that place of worship or safety, and really begin to live these principles in our lives when it can be most challenging. And so listening to you describe, you know, everyone from a physician to a firefighter to the kitchen staff, it's really about how do we take every aspect of our life experience and begin to bring it into this practice that can invite consciousness and healing. So thank you for that. Thank you for sort of affirming what, you know, we certainly saw in the research, and to hear this kind of program being applied in the context of a hospital is really beautiful. And now, Janet, let me ask you the same kind of question. How do we give people some practical insights into this? Let's take your notion of habitats for healing and think about how any environment that we're living in becomes a habitat for healing. How can we share with everyone some practical ideas of how we integrate that into our lives?
Question. I really so enjoyed listening to Elliot, and I want to pick up on one of the last things that he said to respond to that, Marilyn, this notion that one of the major problems for healers or people that find themselves in a healing role in general is that they don't take time to do their own work, to transform their own lives. And for me, the Habitats for Healing were conceived really as first and foremost as places where the staff isn't dying, where the environment is so healthy that the people that are working in it are nourished at the same time as they're trying to nourish other people. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that we can have environments in which people are actually trying to heal and which the people that are trying to facilitate that healing are absolutely dying. It doesn't make any sense. So one of the starting places in this model is with the healthcare professional, and the starting place with the healthcare professional is within the healthcare professional. So it's exactly what Elliot is saying, but it's simply in a different different context or different framework, but precisely the same message, which is that we have to help people find a way to reconnect with what is already there, help people reconnect with what is true and good and beautiful, and to be able to work out of that place that is true and good and beautiful and that is truly a place of service, because that's where it will go if we sit deeply enough and come deeply enough into communion and into touch with our own true nature, true self, the absolute, the ground of being. It doesn't matter what your language is. The next thing that will happen will be the impulse to serve. Just give it away. And this is the piece that's been missing from some of our work in previous decades that was around self-realization, self-actualization, self-development, self, look at the self, the self, the self, the self, which is all great, but it's tended to be the small self, little self, egoic self, and really what's required now is the cultivation of true self, the capital S self, and that always has something to do with service, which is why we're saying, you know, off the pillow, out of the pew, back into service. And so we recognize that our self-growth, all of our self-help, all of our personal healing work has an end that is larger than us. It's not just about me getting happier and me manifesting the car of my dreams and me living the life I always wanted. It's that there are other people out there. There is a world that is suffering. And we have the opportunity through our own personal development, our own struggle, our own willingness to take on the practice on the pillow, so we have something to bring with us off the pillow, that we become willing to be what I sometimes refer to, and of course by now perhaps it's an old metaphor, the imaginal cells for a new healthcare system that is the vision holders for what's possible, for what real healing looks like, for what real healing is about, which is so much more than the elimination of our signs and symptoms of disease. So, you know, when we say, well, we want something practical, we often, I think, erroneously think of we want something easy. But it ain't easy, necessarily. And yet, some would say it's the easiest thing in the world to just wake up. I think it is the absolutely most practical thing in the world to do to cultivate consciousness, which sounds like, you know, it sounds like the juxtaposition. Well, you're out there talking about consciousness. We want something practical. I think both probably Elliot and I would both say, this is the most practical thing you can do, is really spend enough time with your own interiority that you begin to recognize that your consciousness is unbounded. That's an immensely practical thing to do. because it leads to a very different way of being in the world, which is precisely the way of being that the world needs right now. Am I making sense? Does this make sense?
Yeah, and I would also say, I mean, again, based in the research, that we know it can be very hard for people to make transformations. And, you know, we talk about the New Year's resolution, and people don't even remember that they made one, let alone what it was, by the end of January. So these habits, like building new habits, building new patterns of behavior, can be something that is challenging for individuals.
Yes.
And, you know, we also know that our brains in some ways are hardwired to resist change. And so when something is being invited to us, this can be the source of some of that suffering that you're both referring to. So I very much appreciate what you're saying, and also want to see that you know, we think about changing our minds may be the simplest thing we can do, and yet it can also be one of the most challenging.
Absolutely. That's why we call it practice. And I think this is what, when you look to the wisdom from the perennial philosophy, and you look at the teachings across all the traditions, practice is at the heart of it. Every one of them prescribes practice of some sort. As Elliot was saying, the training of the mind, the cultivation of interiority, the cultivation of access, depths of our own connection with Source, requires time and attention, and that's simply another way of saying practice. So, yeah, by no means do we want to suggest that's the thing to do, but it's imminently practical. That's the point that I'm making.
Yeah. That's beautiful. And I also think that, you know, opening back to how you started, Janet, with inviting everyone into the conversation, one of the things, again, that came out of the research we did was how important having a supportive community can be as people are living into these practices, so that we can help and serve and support one another as we're trying to develop new pathways. So I very much invite us to think about what is our community of support and how is it that we can serve one another in the way that this teleseminar series today is supporting a broad outreach of these principles to a lot of people. I'm intrigued by the fact that as I think about where the three of us are situated, you know, you've got Elliot on the shores of the Atlantic Ocean in Martha's Vineyard, and you in Boulder, Colorado, midway in the country, and me in Petaluma, California, near the Pacific Ocean, and thinking about how even though there is this distance between us, there is this common community that is exploring in this way together. And that feels very vital and very reassuring to me. And I wonder now if we want to open up a little bit for some questions, and then we can come back and continue our conversation informed by part of that community. So does
sure.
that seem like a good time to do that?
Yeah, we can go back and forth. Absolutely. So if you have any questions you'd like to ask, just touch one on the keypad. I also see there was a couple that have already happened on the webcast. Webcast, you can type them in the sidebar. So there was one question from the webcast about, it often seems that the most conscious person in a family seems to carry the illness of the family. Do you feel like there's some unconscious agreement to carry the family shadow, which is in the form of illness? It's kind of a provocative question.
Mm-hmm. So either one of you want to tackle that one?
Go ahead, Janet.
No, I was going to say, I have to sit with it. I mean, that's a question I have to sit with. I think it's a deep question.
Yeah, I do think it's a deep question. And there is the distinction that I think is important between the psychological work, whether that's the psychological conscious or unconscious, and spiritual work, or work with understanding the mind, inner work. One spends time with content, whether that's unconscious content, collective consciousness, personal consciousness, the history, the manner in which it's born, etc. Where spiritual work and development really cuts through to the essence of who and what we are and to a place of being and presence that's really beyond all cognition, memory, time, and all of the psychological constructions. So in a way, the question can be answered, I think, from two perspectives, one that's psychological and one that's spiritual. The spiritual one would say nobody carries anything except their own essence and place of being, if we can touch that and remember that, that is the basis of everything, and everything else is an add-on or a superimposition. From a psychological perspective, I think we can construct many kind of viewpoints, including the one that was just given to us, or one that's diametrically opposed to that, because these are psychological constructions. They do not exist in a spiritual reality at all. So from my own perspective, I try to work with people from the place of inner development, where the basic ground of all being is simply a simple, ordinary awareness, presence, and beingness, which is non-cognitive. So it doesn't hold anything at all. It just is. It's a place of suchness. And that undercuts all of the psychological work. It's like cutting a tree down at the root rather than taking off one leaf at a time. So that's how I generally approach it with people, and try not to get into the constructed psychological questions.
Great. Stephen, do you have another?
Sure. Actually, I have three people with general pins. I'm just going to mic one of them. One of you is live.
Well, I'll take it. This is Barge in Ohio. Thank you. I want to thank you for the blessing that kind of brought us consciously together. I really felt it viscerally. I felt it in my body. I also want to say that I am just blown away by the focus and the intelligence and the speed of what's going on right now. I'm remembering like 20, 30 years ago, this sort of slow, dreamy beginning of things, and I want to honor people who have been working all this time, and including all of you, to get to this speed, to get to this focus, and want to encourage everybody that's listening that's just starting out on making new pathways to go for it, because even if it seems like it's slow and there's resistance, what can happen in a very short time is quite amazing, and I'm blown away by it. And I just wanted to honor somebody who's in that lineage, who is Polly Delavitt, who just passed away, and she had a program through Noetics.
She did.
Yes, she did. And she had a global medicine initiative that was college accredited that she put together and just wrote the curriculum for, and it was 4 weeks for fourth-year medical students to learn, not only learn alternative medicine, but to do what you're talking about, to do inner work on themselves. And the letters that we got, I helped her with it, and the appreciations that we got, people said, I finally remembered why I wanted to be a healer, or thank you for my medical school detox. So this is such important work, and I just thank you so much, and I'm just so stirred by the intellect and the focus that you're all bringing to this day. And, Elliot, I wanted to know if there's any way to access your work, your program, if you're not in whatever area you're in, like for someone to begin this practice, what you would recommend or how to access that.
Well, again, a book is coming out with the CD, and it, that I hope will help people in this coming fall. But you raise a very important question. When I came back from Asia, after many years there, back and forth, and I decided I did not want to travel around and do programs anymore. I really wanted to be in my community or any community, because I felt what I had learned is there is a teacher, and that teacher is there for you whenever you need that person, that their commitment is to be with you in your life through that process. It's of enormous help. So when people come into a process here, or whether it's individually over the phone or whatever way, as long as I am, I'm there to help them through that process. That's my work. And I find that kind of commitment one-to-one until somebody, steps into another direction if they choose, or another help, or their own work without help, is so essential. So I haven't unraveled the mystery of how to really extend this. Because extending it's somewhat difficult to do it without that one-to-oneness. Now, perhaps there's ways that this can be done with electronic media, or ways that it couldn't previously. But I think it's a really important question, because of this one-to-one relationship, and I think, Janet, you would confirm that from your own work, is so critical. It was to me in Asia, where it's the tradition to teach and to have a teacher available. And I found that it's so important here, because if people see how strongly I am committed to them, whatever it takes, whenever they want to call me, and I mean that, and I do, whatever they need, I'm committed to them really making this happen. Now, if they feel that I'm committed to them, then they have a commitment to themselves to mirror that. And I hope we can find a way to do this type of thing long distance, because I think we have to. I think some of it can be done by book and a CD and so on, but I don't think it substitutes adequately for this kind of relationship that is there whenever you really need it. And it's a spiritual relationship. It's about practice. It's about practice in life and practice in sitting, about growing and developing wisdom and compassion. It's not about psychology. So the answer is, I going out there with a book and hope that somehow we can find a way in which this work can be done one-to-one, more intimately, long-term, electronically. But it's a very important question, because when I found that I was going talking here and there in the country, people get very excited. They hear new ideas, new concepts, they go home and nothing changes. So I found I was doing basically entertainment. I really wasn't creating change until I really brought myself directly, completely, and wholeheartedly, and put myself on the line with each person for as long as they needed me. And it was a lot different than dropping in and dropping out. So how we do that in a way that works now in our time with the media available, I'm not at all sure, but what you may have or anybody else, I think would be very helpful.
So I might add something, Elliot, because you did, you said I might agree, and I do. I think the one-to-one relationship, particularly when we're talking about negotiating the spiritual journey, if we want to put it that way, is so essential. And one of the modern ways of doing that, it's not so modern really, is through spiritual direction, spiritual guidance, which is, of course, what my work is. And but what I would say to people out there is that is an avenue that you can look at. There is a whole website for spiritual directors called Spiritual Directors International, and they have a seek and find guide where you can look for spiritual directors in your area. And some of us, myself included, do spiritual guidance, spiritual direction over the phone. Now, here's the rub. People are come from very different perspectives. So Elliot is very clear that the perspective that he's bringing is informed pretty strongly through the Eastern traditions and Buddhist practice. My practice has evolved through really contemplative Christianity. I've been a practitioner of centering prayer, Thomas Keating, for decades, but then broadened into the interspiritual perspective, the wisdom of the perennial philosophy, as I said. And so if you find a spiritual director that has that kind of a perspective, you'll find perhaps a broader container for the work, that the spiritual work. But it is a resource for people, and to find a one-to-one spiritual guide can be really useful, I think, on this journey.
I really need to acknowledge what we just learned here about a dear friend and colleague, Polly, who I think all of us served on the Global Medicine Education faculty at one point or another. IONS was a collaborator in developing that with Polly, and really looking at ways that we can help bring these principles of self-care and spirituality and integral approaches into the medical school education. And she was a real champion for that. So I have to acknowledge that I didn't know that, and I am, feeling very saddened with that news, and also appreciative of how each individual's precious life can contribute to this greater whole and this emerging story. So I just wanted to pause, actually, and just respect Polly and the work she did, and all of us as temporary inhabitants of planet Earth, and how, again, going back to the idea of how precious our lives are, that concept is something that needs to be moved beyond, our heads and really fully embraced in terms of how we're living our lives every minute of the day. So thank you for telling us about that. And
Marilyn, I want to add to it. I had the same impulse. I really wanted to take us all, maybe this whole collective that's sitting together, even if you've not known Polly, we can take a moment and send her lots of love. And what I would add to your beautiful reflection is what an amazing, almost icon for what we're talking about Polly was, because We know, those of us that knew her over the years, her battle at the physical level with cancer that kept recurring, and her absolute love of life and trust in the healing process kept her doing what she needed to do at the physical level. But the thing that was so extraordinary from my point of view was she never saw herself as ill. She continually saw herself as whole and healing, even after radical surgeries that left her speech impaired and all kinds of physical things. This was a radiant human being who continued to see herself as healing. And this is so critical, that healing is not limited to the structure and function of our bodies, but is something way beyond that. And she was a tremendous teacher of that. So maybe we can take a moment to just everyone really send this being, Polly, our great love and appreciation. Is that okay, Marilyn?
I think it's beautiful. And to draw that distinction between healing and curing, where sometimes we confuse the two, but thank you to Polly and to all of the people who have contributed to this emerging story of healing and healing the wholeness of our being. Stephen, do you have someone else ready?
Yeah, we have various webcasts. Let's go to a webcast question from Raji. It says, what is the role empathy plays in consciousness and healing, and how can an empathic person protect themselves while doing inner work?
Good question.
Well, this may be a little bit controversial, but I want to make the distinction between empathy and compassion, because they're actually very different things. Empathy is a feeling or emotion or a sense inside that rises in me when I am a witness to another person's suffering, which evokes in me as a result in part of my own past experiences a feeling of anguish and that feeling of anguish and distress that I perceive to be in the other person, but I'm really experiencing it through my own personal experience, and it's an emotion, and it does bring an identification, but as an emotion it also brings the draining effect of a negative emotion or of a difficult emotion, which is exhaustion essentially, or of that nature. And it's also fleeting, as all emotions are fleeting. Compassion is not driven emotionally. It's driven by wisdom and understanding. And it's an understanding of the difficulty of the human condition as it presents itself in another person, their suffering, the understanding to some extent the causes of human suffering in that other person as well as myself and others, and the desire to do something about it. So it's long-lasting. It's wisdom-based rather than emotionally-based. And it has a very deep, sustained feeling with it. And it's very different than empathy, which to a large extent is autobiographical and is fleeting. It does provide an identification, but it's fleeting and it's exhausting. And it doesn't really embrace the human condition in its totality. So I think compassion that comes from an understanding of the human condition, for deep caring for it, for wisdom about it, is not exhausting at all. It's quite filling. It's the emotional reaction inside to another person's suffering that is the that is what's exhausting.
Yeah, so I would add to that this is exactly one of the things that, talking about practical, Marilyn, that when I work with nurses and try to help them remain vital in their work rather than getting drained, it's first learning, and I would say this to the caller, first learning what your own physical cues are to when you're actually getting hooked into an empathic, or what I call a sympathetic response, which is this raw emotional response to the person or the situation in front of you. We first have to bring awareness to the fact that that's even happening, because that's what is basically unconscious in so much of our interaction. We get hooked by something in this person's story, and there is an empathetic or sympathetic response, and it's a raw outflow of this kind of, oh, you poor thing, energy, which, by the way, is not really useful to the person either. But it's unconscious. So we have to first learn to notice what's going on in my body, what's happening to me in this moment, and kind of develop a dual consciousness so that we're aware of the person we want to serve in front of us, but we also maintain a sense of our own being and what's happening. And once you do that, you notice when you're getting hooked into the story, the emotional feeling it that Elliot is talking about, the negative draining effect of it. And through awareness, then, you can shift what you're doing in your own consciousness. So when I address this issue clinically, I try to help people first notice and then shift. So when you notice the hook, this is the opportunity to take a deep breath, come back into the self, to connect with unconditional love and compassion, which is, in fact, connected to the unconditional love and compassion of the universe, if you want to think of it that way, or source. And take a deep breath and then respond to this person out of that place. This is, as Elliot said, this is not a draining place. This is a place of immense fullness. So that's a short version of the practice.
Beautiful reflections. Stephen, do you have somebody else?
Sure. Peggy, you're live.
Oh, hi. Thanks. I have a two-part question. A couple of years ago, I just felt just guided, and I just felt so hungry for connecting with God and God's love. And so I just said, I'm just going to sit on my couch, and that's all I'm going to do. And I just began sending my attention energy up through my crown chakra. And after about an hour, I began to feel this deep peace, and about another half an hour, waves of love. And I found undulating waves of love rolling through my body all the way down to my toes. And for about 6 or 8 hours a day, and I could get up and eat breakfast and eat lunch and just sat on the couch and kept doing this. And after about 3 weeks of doing this, my question has two parts. One is I found that if I would talk on the phone or look on my computer, I'd instantly lose this blissful rolling energy. And so I quickly learned that I had to keep my attention, about 85% of my attention on the feeling, maybe only 15% of the phone call, and then I could stay centered in it. So my question is, any advice you might have of other ways of staying connected to source? And then secondly, when I was looking for guidance, I called up two people because I graduated from Harvard Divinity School, and I knew I was connecting with God, but I was looking for some spiritual direction. So I called Herb Benson and told him what was happening, and he said, oh, you better be careful, you could go crazy. I thought, I was like, well, that wasn't too encouraging. And then I called another person who had been head of a worldwide church, which I won't name, for years, and told her what was happening, and I could tell she was jealous that she'd never experienced it. And I was disappointed that I couldn't get more spiritual direction, and I've since found a group to meditate with, the Brahma Kumaris, who are very comfortable connecting this deeply and profoundly with God's love. But I was still looking for more spiritual guidance and wondered if you all, what you might have as guidance for me. I can go into it. I can feel it. I can function. I work professionally in integrative medicine, so I can do my work. I can go back into it when I want to. So I know I'm not crazy. I feel very blessed, but I would just love this opportunity for any spiritual guidance or suggestions you might have.
Beautiful, Peggy. Thank you. So either one of you want to jump in there?
I guess, Peggy, as I just sit here and try to receive this story, what arises for me is actually a question. Because I'm not clear about what it is that you're seeking around this. Sounds like what you just described is that you described a journey where it was you couldn't somehow find what you felt you needed for support several years ago, but that now you have a fulfilling job, you do your work, you have this capacity to connect deeply with your sense of source. So I'm not sure what it is that you're seeking that you feel you need guidance around at this point.
That if I had asked you this question when this was happening, what each of you might have said?
At the time, so you're talking...
Yes, but I mean, I still haven't found I mean, even among the Brahmo Kumaris, I'll get into the state, and they'll say, "Oh, don't." They'll say, "Oh, open your eyes, don't go there." It's like I can tell. They say we've had people who've gone there and just go crazy or get too ungrounded, and so I can still feel in them a level of fear about getting too connected to God. So I really haven't found all the answers I'm looking for. So I'm just looking for more guidance of when I'm able to deeply connect with this. Any more guidance from someone who might be further along the path than I am.
And if I might just reframe the question a little bit to be more general, to say that I think the experience you described of being able to find this unit of experience within yourself, but then feeling pulled away from it through the modern distractions of our time, and inviting Elliot and Janet to give us some suggestions on how it is that, you know, it's the same comment I made earlier about you have to get out of the pew or off of the pillow and into life. How do we stay in that flow state and that sense of the sacred connection at the same time that we're living with all these weapons of mass distraction?
Well, I'm going to ask the listener to just bear with me. It is not an unusual thing in spiritual practice to have what it calls meditative or spiritual experiences. These are actually considered to be obstructions if one gets attached to them or seek more of them. They're not actually considered to be the deepest level of experience, which is not really an ecstatic state. It's simply an ordinary, a simple state of awareness and presence and beingness in life, which has a delight to it because it's relieved of all of the afflictions and struggles. And the advice, which is not mine, but the advice that's given when people have meditative experiences, such as the one you're describing, is let it go. Let it go. Don't seek it again. Let it go. Because if you let it go, you'll go deeper to the next level and to the next level until you get to a place of a very grounded awareness and presence, which is quite simple and ordinary. And with that awareness and presence, when it's really stabilized, it is life. And everything arises and falls within it. And one is able to be complex outside and simple inside simultaneously. It's not like you have to hold something. There's nothing to hold. It's the natural place of who and what we are. But we mistake that place for a meditative experience, so we don't go further, and we get into a place of desire and attachment. So this would be the traditional advice, let it go, and go further into meditative experience or meditative state. And so I think the kind of guidance that would be helpful here is that of a practice meditator who really can introduce you to what that meditative experience is and how to go beyond it and let it go and identify that place of suchness and selfness and presence and beingness, which is not separated from life. Everything is within it, and one is able to live within that and be quite active in life at the same time. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama would be a perfect example. He's quite out there in the world, yet inside he's living in a place of inner space that's open and vast and broad and is not separate from the outside work. Outside and inside are really inseparable. So I think that would be the traditional answer, to let that go with a meditative experience and continue to refine and develop meditation to reach a place which is really the essence and source. Then one's life becomes one's work, one's work becomes one's life, one's practice becomes one's life, and one's life is one's practice. The problem you're having is that you haven't had that, and neither have I, by the way, have that kind of stable experience of essence, and therefore it's trying to hold on to two separate things. And it's not really, they're not really separate. They're one when you reach them, when you come to them at that profound, deep level. At least that's what they tell me. I'm just a beginner at all this, so I can't verify it with my own experience. But that's how I would respond to that. Janet, what would be your thoughts about that?
I was really getting that same, putting that same response together in my, I had what the guidance that I would have is that this is, that there is guidance that's been given. People are sharing guidance with our caller. But it's not, doesn't feel like it's the guidance that feels comfortable. And every tradition says the same thing. Don't get attached to the experiences. It's not about the experiences. And these can be distractions to the connection. And so the teaching is to let it go. So I would agree that that's good guidance, and every tradition does teach that there are dangers in getting too attached to these experiences and confusing the experiences with what it is that we actually are seeking, which is beyond the experience. So that's actually good guidance, I think.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the question and those really insightful comments. Stephen, do you have somebody else?
Melanie is now live.
Hi, Melanie.
Hi. How did you know it was me?
Wow. You know, that's exactly the question. This is just amazing. I only got to tune in a little bit ago, and this is exactly the answer that I've been looking for. I punched the number in before you said anything, but that if you could just underline that last part for me, I'd appreciate it. It's not getting attached to the experience. I've been trying to stay in that state of essence, and this is an incredible distinction. Your practice is your, how did you say it? One is the one and the other is the same. And that
also, you don't need to ever try to stay in that place of essence. The moment you try to stay in it, you're trying to hold something that is not it. It's an effortless place. Now, it's hard for us to really touch it and remain in it for very long. We have to really do the work to remove the obstacles. But the actual place itself is completely effortless. It's just an ordinary way of being. It's like a little kid and his wonderment and innocence in the world before their conceptual mind wakes up. It's just there, and you're designed to hold. And it's the holding that doesn't let us get to that place where there's nothing to hold, I think, as Janet said. And when we experience that, and again, this is what I have been told, I don't have a direct experience of it, then there is no distinction between the so-called meditative and post-meditative state. It's all one experience. It's all a place of presence and being, and we live and function within that perfectly well. There's no place to leave and no place to go. And yet to find that place, to uncover it requires removing the obstacles and the veils and the coverings that lay over it. So any holding on, it's just the conceptual mind and the ego trying to, again, satisfy itself with something that's far more limited than is possible for us.
You know, the idea of, oh, my greater concept, I've had this experience so frequently recently. I'm fairly new to integral theory. And I've spent a little bit of time with some of those people in conversation, and I've had the experience. So when I switch to thinking I'm out of it, am I in the ego space again? Do you know what I'm saying?
You're again in the place of separation. You separated from the experience.
Isn't that just odd? Isn't that just so odd?
It's not odd at all. It's the human experience. It's what we do. It's completely not odd.
You mean being human is not pathological?
There you go. It's not a problem. It's what is. It's what is. And it's why we practice. But I think bringing in the integral model is a really, this is a good place for that. I was thinking about that too, that we can sometimes get hung up on different states of being and thinking that we've reached a certain state, the difference between stages, so that we have these peak experiences, but they haven't stabilized. This is what Eliot's talking about, that there comes a point, we're told in the traditions, where we stabilize at a different stage of being or a different stage of consciousness is what the integral, Wilbur's integral model would call it.
How does that happen? How can I deliberately generate and cultivate that?
Well, the traditions would say you can open to it, you can cultivate the soil for it, but you cannot make it happen.
No kidding.
So our practice is the tilling of the soil, in that the Christian contemplative metaphor would be, my centering prayer practice is tilling the soil. So on the day that grace rains down, my soil is ready to receive it.
Oh, wow. That's
in
beautiful.
In Christian contemplative tradition, it's a joint work of your spirit where your work to remove the obstructions, as Eliot said, tilling the soil, is met by divine love and compassion. The timing of which is utterly out of your hands.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, and therein lies the rub.
Yeah, relax and enjoy your practice. Do it because
you know, someone said once that the ultimate, the mother of all practices is returning to practice. And so that's just, there's nowhere else to go for me except that.
Yeah, so love the practice, love the path, and trust.
Yeah. And your teacher, who was such a great teacher and master, Aikido practitioner, and created a program with Michael Murphy on integral transformative practice. And I just, his words come to me of loving the plateau and those places where it feels as though we haven't gotten to where it is that we aspire to get to is the perfect place to be. And how do you stay there and feel comfortable exactly where you are when you're there? So thank you for your insights and bringing in the integral theory to the conversation. We really appreciate that.
If I may comment on Marilyn, one of the problems is that the way practice is taught in our culture, certainly Eastern practice, it's often taught as a relaxation technique. And therefore it really doesn't change very much. It just provides a level of relaxation when it's being done. It doesn't provide the opportunity for any insights or growth in consciousness. Or it's taught as a mindfulness practice, which is very helpful. But mindfulness practice is a cognitive practice, and it's a foundational practice. It's not the end. It's just the beginning of being able to pay attention. And what we really want to do is go beyond that to open up those deeper places. So one of the problems are we don't have meditative training or practice training that really emphasizes the development of consciousness beyond relaxation or beyond mindfulness. And this is, meditation training has been very, very, very well defined, refined. There are many approaches, many practices. It's not something that's you just close your eyes and do. So the kind of proper guidance for it isn't often there. And the other thing I just wanted to mention, to bring in the word integral again, is whenever we're talking about developing consciousness, we are simultaneously talking about integral practice, because you cannot reach the higher mind, the higher subtle stages of physiological harmony without having the harmony of a higher consciousness. You can't reach relationships that are based on otherness rather than selfness without developing consciousness. You can't move from trying to scavenge from the world what I need to survive to serving the world without a higher level of consciousness. So when we talk about consciousness, it's really a surrogate word for developing the entire integral model.
In our book, Consciousness and Healing, Integral Approaches to Mind-Body Medicine, Dean Ornish has a chapter, and I know Dean was on this program earlier today, and it's a quote that I love to use in lectures, and he says, the swamis and the sages didn't learn about these tools of meditation in order to get their blood pressure down or to perform better at board meetings. You know, they really used it as a means of transformation and spiritual transcendence. And I think that in our Western-based culture, with all of our emphasis on the physical, material aspects of experience, that we sometimes forget, and a lot of the research, the vast majority of the research, is focused on outcomes that really, kind of trivialize the depths that you are describing, both of you, in your own work, in your own practice, and how you're bringing this into healthcare. So it's important for us to remember that the path also involves stress management and stress reduction, and that's important, and we see that that's really very significant for alleviating some of the physical distresses. In fact, the vast majority of physical distresses that we experience as a civilization, but that we're also talking about something more and something that allows us to connect to a broader whole. So thank you for that. Okay, we have time for a couple more, Stephen.
Sure. We'll keep rolling. Halsey, you have the mic.
Hi, thank you very much. I wanted to find out a little bit about what you two see as the markers of this State of Union. I've been meditating for quite a while, 25 years or so, and, you know, having read all the standard books, The Cloud of Unknowing, Thomas Keating's work, Sri Aurobindo's work with integral yoga, I wanted to find out, you see, my measure, so to speak, which is a very Western concept, measuring how good you're doing at what you're doing, I measure it by the subtleties that I see in how I express, for lack of a better word, my humanness, you know, that I'm much less angry, that I'm much more patient, that I do embody the compassion you were talking about rather than the empathy. What's the specific evidence that we can look for to see that we're not on an ego path? Because I think none of us have ever gone through our journeys without encountering people or ourselves when we're in a state of deception.
What do you mean by that?
Self-deception, when you think, I think I'm getting somewhere, and it's all ego malarkey.
Yeah, such a great question. I love it because I feel like I've lived with that one. And I think that, tell me your name again.
Halsey Taylor.
Halsey. I feel as though, for starters, one of the indications is the very willingness to ask that question. So the very willingness to face the self and say, who's speaking here? Who's acting here? What's acting? What's moving? The very willingness to engage that question is, first of all, an indication of sincerity on the journey. You know, so that's beautiful right there as a beautiful fruit. The second thing I would add, and I know Elliot will have something to add, if we look at this question through the lens of the Christian contemplative tradition, it's very clear what the measures are, and they are, in fact, the fruits of the Spirit. So this is very clear Christian cosmology, that the person who is truly aligned in the path and cultivating the true self, that the fruits of the Spirit will be with that person, and they're exactly the kinds of things that you talk about. The fruits of the Spirit, patience, forgiveness, long-suffering, kindness, those are the fruits of contemplative practice. And in fact, it's one of the teachings in that tradition that you don't look to any particular period of prayer or practice to say, well, was this good or not good? You know, did I do a good job? But where you can look is to your life. Are you a more loving person? Are you a kinder person? Are you a more compassionate, patient person? Those are the only measures as far as I'm concerned. So, Elliot, what would you add?
I would basically ditto that, and I don't think I need to add to that. I think you articulated very well. I would just add that we're all on the gradual path, and that means that we will have backs and forths and ups and downs and reminded to be very humble many, many times. And it's like a meditation. Sometimes it's noisy, sometimes it's not. And that we have to be extremely patient with ourselves and look for these fruits, not one day to the next, but look at over months, over years. How have I changed? Am I those things moved towards the directions that Janet mentioned? And that's the process. It's a slow, progressive process of developing otherness and the other qualities that were mentioned. And we have to be very patient with ourselves and kind of laugh when we get stuck, laugh when we end up reacting, and after all this work we say, my God, and my button got pushed and I went off again.
Exactly.
Just kind of laugh at it and move on, and realize how that happens a lot less. We learn about it, we realize it much more quickly. So tremendous patience and measuring over long periods of time. But the fruits, I think, are basically as Janet has described them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Webcast question. We have Maria wants to know if you have any centering or meditation recommendations for children.
I could jump in just for a minute and say that there is a very vibrant field being developed around social and emotional intelligence and bringing contemplative mind into society and into education. There's also a lot of resistance to it in the public schools where, you know, there are questions about paradigms and worldviews, but there are a number of different practices that are being introduced for young people now. Really simple things of watching the breath, allowing a reflection of thoughts as they bubble up, maintaining an attitude that is open to the kind of curiosity and questioning of ideas that come. One of the things we've built at the Institute of Noetic Sciences is a curriculum around what we're calling worldview literacy and really helping young people. We're in a number of high schools right now as well as in some elementary schools and continuing education, second-year colleges, looking at how it is that we can cultivate an awareness that we perceive the world through a lens of perception that is a worldview, that is guided by our own personal life experiences, whether it's our upbringing or the culture that we're embedded in, and that there's also this larger worldview that begins to help define our experiences. And so what we're inviting young people to do in the classrooms is to reflect on their worldview. Where do your beliefs come from? And it's been really astonishing to watch their surprise that they had never, first of all, been asked where their beliefs come from, and secondly, that they really are curious about the fact that they have held with certainty particular orientations or opinions or views of life, and that once you begin to reflect on them, you can hold them a little more lightly. And so there's both this reflection quality, there's breath work, and there's a way of helping to calm and reduce the reactivity to people whose worldviews may be different from your own. And then the dialogic process of really creating conversations that matter and deep inquiry in groups, and in particular then groups that have differing opinions, because this can be a true way of liberating ourselves from being fixed in certain conceptualizations and really allowing young people to explore with a more open mind the nature of their consciousness. So that's just something through IONS that we've really begun to take these ideas of consciousness transformation and apply them in the context of classrooms so that we can help future generations to live into some of these practices. But, you know, I'm sure both Janet and Elliot have things to add to that.
I don't think I have a lot to add, actually, Marilyn. It's not an area that I've done much work in, but I'm absolutely thrilled that you and the Institute do have some base of experience in it. The only thing I would add to it is how we model as individuals to young people is of great importance, that our own peace, our own service, our own heart, these things are learned by children at every age. If we can, we actually bring those to bear. And in traditional Eastern societies, in any case, they speak about the fact that what we have to learn as adults is really innate to a child who grows up in a large extended family, listening to the stories and the songs of Miller Raper from 2 years old on and espousing values of service and concern for others. So I think the remedial programs, which we need to do because we don't have that kind of background often, which Marilyn's talking about, is so very important. But we also have to remember that as we grow ourselves, we're becoming instruments of modeling and examples for younger people to see in our own family and elsewhere.
Exactly, and I don't have a lot to add either because it's not my area other than that I know that there is a book called Centric Prayer for Children, but I can't recommend it or not. I haven't read the book, and I know there are books on meditation for children, but again, I'm not in a position to recommend any of them.
Yeah, I would recommend going to the, you know, the Contemplative Mind in Society. Mirabai Bush has put together a fantastic program. CASEL, I think it's the Coalition for Social and Emotional Intelligence, or Emotional and Social Intelligence, has a lot in terms of, you know, insight and suggestions for how to bring this into the classroom. And then if you just go to noetic.org and look under education on our Worldview Literacy Program, it is evolving on a daily basis in ways that we hope are very nurturing to this kind of developmental process. So thank you for that. Stephen?
Sure. Julie, you're live.
Okay, great. I've got a question. I've been meditating off and on for a good long while, but never very steadily. I'll start, and I'll really enjoy it, and I'll start getting really into it. And then I don't know why this is. I don't know what to do about it or how to get around it. But I'll start getting some kind of resistance from my body. I'll start itching. The more I do it, the worse I'll itch. It'll be really fierce. It'll feel like some bug came up and bit me. I mean, just all of a sudden, this feeling of itching just bites into me. I don't really know what that's about. I don't know if you've heard of that before or something like that. If you have any suggestions how to get past it, I'd really like that. Thank you.
One of the things that I know from the Living Deeply work that we did on transformation and the different practices is that there are many, many, many different forms of meditation practice, and not all of them involve sitting. I know Lauren Artress, who created the Labyrinth program in Veriditas, talks about how sitting meditation didn't work for her at all, and she ended up, you know, taking on and developing a program for herself that was a walking meditation. So there are different paths forward. That's what I would offer to that. Elliot, it sounds like you're ready to say something about that too.
Well, I think that's true. There are many different kinds of meditative processes, and we have to remember really listening to another person when they're speaking and not being drawn into our interpretations, judgments, or our own commentary. Coming back always to their words is a meditation. Understanding that another person's emotional afflictions come from a place of helplessness and thoughtlessness and almost like a disease, and are a source of a reason for compassion rather than reactivity. That's a meditation, being mindful during the day of whatever we're doing in the moment, drawing our attention to it is a form of meditation. In terms of sitting meditation, it is a very personalized experience, and so it's really important to have somebody who can sit and say this or that or the other thing. There are many, many experiences that happen during meditation of which what you're saying is one of them. Certainly, if you're having those feelings of itching or whatever's going on, you don't want to sit there and struggle with it. You want to scratch, get up, move around, and then start all over again if that's what your intention is. But I think having a meditation teacher who can work with those different things is very important, but also remembering that meditation has so many opportunities during the day, and if we bring them all together, that's how we ultimately end up transforming our life.
Anna, did you have anything you wanted to add?
I think the only piece that I would add is that there's also inquiry as a spiritual practice. And so
if you're
curious about it, you know, you can just do a little inquiry around just this. So when you notice itching is arising, you notice that. You say, wow, itching arising, and you turn awareness towards itching. And you allow that to be present, bring awareness to it, and see what unfolds out of itching. I mean, that's an approach, you know. If you're curious, you could try that as well. And inquiry is wonderful, deep spiritual practice.
In other words, you're saying move away from the aversion to it, the attachment to not liking it and not wanting it, and lean into it a bit. Become aware of it and observe it and see where it takes you, because the aversion only makes it worse.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that question. I wonder, given the time we have left, would you two like to say something by way of closure, you know, to wrap up your thoughts here?
Can we do a quick to it's always nice to have an opt-in for people who would like to stay in contact with folks. So maybe if we could first Janet, do you have anything in particular, if people raise their hands by pressing 1, that you can, you have newsletter or other events coming up that you'd like to mention that we can take an opt-in list? People can also do it on the webcast just by typing 1 into that question field.
I'd love to have the contact information so that when I have my next Touching Body, Tending Soul teleseminar ready, I can let them know about that if they're interested in that. And if they're interested in information about spiritual direction, we can do that too.
Great. So touch 1 if you would like that information, and we'll just share that information with Janet. And then how about you, Elliot? Anything particular that you'd like to keep people updated on?
I think if people go to my website, which the address you have there, I think it's in the information, then there's also an email link, and I'd be happy to both share whatever information is on there and to respond to any questions that come my way.
Right. So if you'd like, we can also share.
I'm sorry. I forgot to say that, too. I do have my – they can find my website, too, at janetquinn.com. I forgot that piece. Thanks.
Okay, great. And so also if you wanted us to share your email with Elliot, just touch 2 and we can do that. And Marilyn, I think because we're co-producing this, everyone will still be in contact with ION, so we probably don't have to do a separate one for you, but we could move to closing.
Well, I do want to let people know that we have a set of courses that are online around integral health, and Janet Quinn has contributed to that. Elliot has contributed. We have 4 courses up right now that are really on integral nursing, but they are equally relevant to anyone who's interested in health and healing. So that would be something for folks who want to go to thenoetic.org, again, look under education and see if there's some next steps there for folks who are interested in these topics. So I think by way of closure, I really want to acknowledge for myself how really deep and authentic this conversation has been and how personally rewarding it is for me. I've, you know, had my own stresses and concerns, and being in this hour and a half of conversation with you has been a deep meditation and a profoundly healing experience. So thank you very much for your contributions. And maybe both of you would like to say something by way of completion.
Well, certainly thank you, Stephen and Marilyn, for making this possible, and this opportunity is to have this really what has been a really wonderful discussion, and everybody who's been listening in, who is certainly present and there with us, really appreciate that presence as well. So thank you, and have a good day for the rest of you. Janet?
Yeah, I feel a deep appreciation for Stephen and the beautiful work that you continue to do with SHIFT and Marilyn at Noetics, and really want to say specifically to each person that's out there in this beautiful circle that we remain in this circle, that we are hearts that are dedicated to the healing of humanity and of this planet, or we wouldn't be sitting in this circle together. And so that circle of intention remains. And just what's yours to joy and with love, and you're enough. You're the medicine, and you're enough. Blessings, and thanks for being with us.
Yes, thank all 3 of you for such a heart-centered and spirit-opening exploration this afternoon. Really beautiful. So thank you all, and you can now depart as you wish. And for those who would like to stick around, we can put you in groups of 4, which are discussion groups, so that you can connect with some of the other people drawn to this summit. We've had people from, I think, 70-plus countries register for the summit. So if you stick around right now, we'll put you in groups of 4. And then we have our next featured person at 3 o'clock, who is Bruce Cryer from HeartMath, which is really going to be a fantastic but shorter program, so do rejoin us at 3 p.m.